Algonquin and Lake Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. Support for the morning show comes from Carthage College, home of the Aspire program and its multifaceted approach to career preparation. The new program is designed to cultivate leadership and entrepreneurial skills while empowering each Carthage student to shape a custom career development plan from the first days on campus. Learn more about the Aspire program at carthage.edu/aspire.
And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. In the midst of the COVID-19 crisis, it's important for us to remember that we have been down this road before, not specifically with COVID-19, but with other public health emergencies and crises, such as the polio epidemic of the late 1940s and early 50s, which was even more terrifying. Tonight, on PBS stations across the country, including Channel 10 in Milwaukee, the American Experience series will rebroadcast a superb documentary about the polio epidemic. And I am going to be replaying now an interview which I did ahead of the documentary's first airing with Sarah Colt. After that, I will replay from the archives my interview with David Oshinsky, whose book Polio, An American Story, was one of the primary source materials for the documentary. We'll finish out the hour with an interview that has nothing to do with COVID-19 whatsoever, a memorable, if brief, interview I was able to record with Madeleine Albright, former Secretary of State, upon the publication of her memoir. Tonight on both of our local PBS affiliates, Channel 10 in Milwaukee, also on Channel 11 in Chicago, you have the opportunity to watch a truly superb documentary for the series American Experience. It is a film which explores the frightening polio scare of the 1950s. The Polio Crusade is a story not only about fear amongst the general public, but also about the fervent efforts of many to do something about it, and what ultimately culminated in what's been called the largest human experiment in history, which of course ultimately had a happy ending, but not before skirting right along the edge of perhaps a deeper crisis. A really extraordinary documentary based at least in part on David Oshinsky's book, Polio, An American Story. You might remember the rebroadcast of that interview on Friday's morning show. Today, I'm pleased to speak with Sarah Colt, writer, producer, and director of this wonderful film. Her previous work on other documentaries includes the marvelous profile of Robert F. Kennedy, another film I enjoyed very much called The Secret Life of the Brain, and a profile of UN Secretary General Kofi Annan, among many other films. Sarah Colt, we welcome you to the morning show.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I'm pleased to be on your show.
Looking forward to this conversation very much. Your film was really terrific. I wanted to say I enjoyed it, but I'm not sure that's quite the word, particularly the opening minutes, which are just harrowing. I think you do such a good job of trying to create for us, or recreate for us, some sense of the enormous fear that gripped so much of the American public. Just talk for a moment about what you learned in your research about that aspect of this story and how you went about trying to powerfully convey that in your film.
Well, it was very striking to me right from the beginning of delving into this project that fear was an important kind of part of the story, that polio hit indiscriminately. It was not just one group of people that were hit. It initially was hitting children, but it then started to spread to adults, and so anyone was susceptible. And so it became really important to me to really get at the fear and understand what people were going through in the period as polio, the epidemics really increased and got worse and worse as the 20th century unfolded. And so we really wanted to find a way to get at that, and the best way to do it was to find one community that was hit. And we started to research that, and we found this community in Wytheville, Virginia, where an epidemic hit in the summer of 1950. And it was a very intense experience that no one in that town has forgotten. And a lot of the people there, you know, still remember it vividly.
And you show us film footage, I assume at least some of it, from that town, from that era. And we see these utterly normal images of normal, idyllic life. And I think that really helps underscore the terror that this disease brought with it. I mean, that it would strike right in the heart of ordinary communities and in the lives of ordinary people, especially children.
Exactly. And, you know, the incredible thing for us, and one of my favorite parts of making history films, is the archival material. And so to be able to tell this story with footage from Wytheville, the footage that we use is all from Wytheville. It's a combination of footage that was shot during the epidemic. So when the epidemic was taking place that summer, there was a film crew that was sent actually by the March of Dimes down to Wytheville. And so the footage you see in the film is accurate to that summer. And then we also were just really excited to find some footage of Wytheville, just kind of everyday life in Wytheville, from before the epidemic. So we were able to really set the scene of this town, and then of course the interviews with people who many of them still live in Wytheville and remember that summer, because it was obviously so, made such an impression on everyone.
I want you to tell our listeners about something especially chilling in that footage we see from that small community. I think of about 5,000 people or so in the heart of Virginia. It is a tote board and escalating numbers, which are seen day after day. Tell us what that tote board was and what those numbers sort of represent in terms of the telling of this story.
Well, the town had a town newspaper, but the editor of the newspaper couldn't keep up with the changing numbers and couldn't keep up with the demand to know what was going on. And so he put a tote board or bulletin board outside of the newspaper office on the main street of Wytheville, and Wytheville is like many small towns, everything at that period was right on Main Street. And every time a new case was reported to the paper, he would go out and replace the number. And every day, and actually hourly, he was updating this board so that people were informed as to the number of cases. So in a town of 5,500 people, or in a community, it's the town and the county, a rural county, they were, the cases were mounting up into, the low hundreds. And, it was very, very terrifying for people. And the town really shut down during the epidemic. I was quite, and it was a way for me as a filmmaker to kind of take, right at the beginning of the film, hopefully get the audience there with people so that we can, really experience the fear, because I think, especially for Americans that didn't live through this, were born after the polio vaccine existed, many people don't even really understand or recognize what a terror it was.
One of the interesting stories told is, I think, by someone named now Anne Crockett Stark. She remembers that summer very vividly, and her brother is one of the victims of that polio outbreak. She tells a little story about what her family did in an effort to safeguard the rest of you and your neighbors from this terrible threat. Tell us what that family did.
Well, they, the parents had, you know, there were other children in the family, and their son was taken off to the hospital with an infectious disease that was potentially going to kill him, but also, you know, potentially disable him for the rest of his life. And so the family, not really knowing what to do, but knowing it was catching, they took every single thing that her Annie B. Crockett Stark's brother owned, and he was, like, you know, just a little boy, took all of his clothes, his toys, everything that he owned, including an incredible comic book collection that Annie remembers vividly, and they took it out into the garden and they just burned everything that he owned, because they were afraid that somehow the virus would be spread through his things. Now, the thing that's so moving about all of this was that actually that really didn't, you know, do anything. That the virus, probably Annie's family, they were all infected with the virus, and it just happened that her brother didn't have immunity and didn't have the antibodies in his system, and that's why he got so sick. So what made polio so terrifying was that one family might be fine, the next door neighbor, everyone in the family would get sick, then the next family down, only, you know, one child would get sick. So it was all very indiscriminate and very confusing.
And I suppose that sort of capriciousness of the disease and the way that it operated, you know, made it still more terrifying, and its very unpredictability. Your film talks about the lengths to which people went to try and safeguard themselves, a kind of pervasive fear. I want you to talk for a moment about one sort of striking tension in the facts, I guess. We are talking about something really frightening, but one of the points of your film is that Basil O'Connor, who really created the March of Dimes and spearheaded the effort to raise funds to combat this threat, did a lot to sort of stoke the public's fears, maybe beyond what was truly reasonable in terms of just how big a threat polio was. Help us understand, I mean, how big a threat was it? I mean, were people more frightened of it than in fact they needed to be or should have been? That's one of the hardest things to understand about this, I think.
I think so. I mean, I thought a lot about this, as you might imagine, and I think, you know, the threat was actually fairly small. The polio virus hit, or it would hit a community. It came out in the summer. Nobody really understood and still doesn't completely understand why it was more prevalent in the summer, but it would sort of bloom in the summer, and the epidemics would happen in the summer. And but the reality was that the number of people who actually would be badly affected by the polio virus was very, very small. You had a much better chance of getting tuberculosis or childhood cancer or, you know, being in a childhood accident than you were of getting polio. But the thing about polio was how devastating it was, and the fact that, you know, other diseases might, you know, and this might sound kind of you know, very sort of tough to say this, but a number of interviewees who I spoke to explained that, you know, measles killed children, and it was obviously devastating to lose a child, but once the child is gone, the child is gone. Polio was so terrifying because your child got horribly sick and might end up being disabled for life, going from a healthy, able-bodied child to a child that couldn't walk, and that was very terrifying. And so it was a great fear. Somehow, you know, it was sort of like at any turn this could happen to you, so that the fear really was much greater than the actual risk. And I think we can really relate to that today, because I think with terrorism, with the fear that of, you know, kidnapping that we live with in our culture, it's much greater than really this, you know, actual risk that we face every day. But somehow the notion that it might happen to us makes you very afraid. And Basil O'Connor was an incredible person. He was a force to be reckoned with, and he was one of these people that understood how to get the smartest, most creative people together to further his cause. And his cause was to raise money to not only help and aid all victims of polio in the United States and pay for their care, so it was basically health insurance for every American who got polio. The March of Dimes promised this and they delivered on it. But he also had pledged to find a vaccine, and he was going to do everything in his power to make that happen. And he was, you know, he went to the best PR people, the best advertising people, and they, you know, recognized that fear was a great motivator. And so to get people to understand how scary polio was really raised a lot of money.
We should mention that he was a law partner of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And I know a lot about FDR. I mean, I really do. But it had never dawned on me that he was stricken with polio as an adult. In fact, I think you tell us he was in his late 30s when he was struck
with
polio.
Exactly, yep.
And that was really quite uncommon, that so often this was a disease which struck children. And so he is a very surprising victim of polio, and of course his high profile makes a great difference in just how much people paid attention to this disease, and it's of course the major reason why Basil O'Connor becomes part of this story.
Exactly. And you know, the March of Dimes really wouldn't exist without FDR, but then this, you know, FDR handed off the helmsmanship to Basil O'Connor, and Basil O'Connor was a really unique person. I mean, he was actually, during World War II, he was head of the Red Cross and head of the March of Dimes, and I mean, he was one of these guys that rarely slept, worked very long days, had, you know, several secretaries working round the clock to keep up with him. He was really quite an amazing person. I had never even heard of him before I started working on this project and read David's wonderful book.
And of course, he is a man possessed when it came to polio. Among the important things he did was sort of turned on its ear the whole notion of how funds should be raised. I mean, and in a sense, in terms of sheer mathematics, he did it exactly backwards from what had always been the traditional approach.
Exactly. At a time when, you know, philanthropies depended on very wealthy donors, one or two rich bankers or you know, industrialists who would give them big, big chunks of money, Basil O'Connor realized during the Depression, when those kinds of funds were drying up, that they needed to find a new source of income. And so using FDR's popularity and really relying on FDR as you know, president of the United States, they turned to the American public and just said, you know, anyone can give and no one is too poor to give a dime to help.
So, you know, they made this radio appeal to every American and asked people to send their change. And the initial plan was to send your change to the White House, to President Roosevelt at the White House. And they really didn't know if this was going to work. And then, you know, several days after the radio appeal, the envelopes arrived and they came in just absolutely massive numbers. Nobody expected it to be this successful. The White House mailroom was overwhelmed. They had never dealt with anything like this. And in fact, they ended up having to take the change over to the Treasury Department and just weigh it, because it would have been such a huge job to count everything. And they made, you know, over $1 million in that first appeal, which they called the March of Dimes. And so that's where it all began. And this notion that every American was going to take part, everyone was going to send something, even if it was just your pocket change, it really seemed to work. And it was that was really the beginning of an amazing fundraising success, which nowadays we kind of take for granted. And we all get those letters from every nonprofit you can think of, but that really started with the March of Dimes.
It's, of course, says something about the level of fear that there would be such a powerful response to that. Another indication of just how terrified people were of polio comes in the wake of this great effort with scientist Jonas Salk and Albert Sabin, his rival, in trying to come up with a vaccine. And one of the things that we are told is that when there was this possibility of a vaccine made from dead virus, that was Jonas Salk's breakthrough to bring about a more quick success in the effort, that when it became possible for children to undergo experiment with this vaccine, I mean, parents were almost delirious to put their children forward to be experimented on with a still largely untested vaccine. I mean, it says something about how frightened people were of this disease that they would willingly allow their children to be given a vaccine which could have been just as dangerous as the disease, if not more so. It really says something about what was going on in the hearts and minds of so many Americans.
Well, I think it's really interesting because for me, there are sort of two things to that, which, number one, I think you're absolutely right that it was the fear that people felt that their child could be hit at any moment, that they were desperate to not have to live with this fear. And so whatever it was going to be, they were willing to try it, even if, as you say, it wasn't fully tested and no one really knew if it was completely safe. The other aspect of it, which I think is so interesting, especially from our perspective in, 2009, is how trusting Americans were of the medical community, of doctors and of scientists. This notion that science was going to cure everything, that we had a tremendous faith in science, and that if your doctor suggested something, you did it. It was just a different era in terms of questioning, and you kind of put all your faith in the medical and scientific community, and so if they suggested something, you did it. And I think that that's just interesting to think about, a very different era. I think we're much more skeptical now. It's a very different time, and we have good reason to be skeptical, but I think there's something to take from this in terms of really thinking about this sort of faith and what does it mean.
We learned so much in the course of your film about many aspects of the terror of polio, including the experience of those who had to live out so much of their lives encased in those infamous iron lungs, which nonetheless did keep people alive. I want you to close by you telling us about some extraordinary footage you have about a dramatic moment when results were finally released to the public about this widespread experiment with this new vaccine, and the extraordinary scene with reporters crowded around an elevator. I mean, that also says so much about the intensity of this experience and the fear that had gripped the country.
Yeah, I mean, it was really the biggest story that anyone could remember. I mean, and certainly the biggest science story. I mean, apart from the moon landing, this probably is the biggest science story that we ever experienced. And so when the results were ready, and it had been a year since the trial vaccine had been given to about 600,000 children, there were 2 million children who took part in the experiment, and 600,000 of those 2 million were given either a placebo or the actual vaccine. And nobody knew which one they had received, and everybody was just absolutely anxious to know whether the vaccine worked and whether their children who would be able to get the vaccine. And so there was a gathering in Michigan where the study had been had taken place, and reporters came from all over the world. I mean, it was a huge, huge story, and people were just waiting with bated breath. And when the results were positive, everybody just let out a sigh of collective relief and excitement, and it just meant that finally children and adults would be safe from this really devastating virus.
So much to take in this extraordinary film, again called The Polio Crusade. And it airs tonight on both Channel 10 in Milwaukee and also Channel 11 in Chicago. And it's writer, producer, and director, Sarah Colt. Sarah Colt, I congratulate you on a superb film, and I'm grateful to you for joining me today on The Morning Show. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure.
You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. For the next few minutes, we explore one of the darkest chapters in American history, the polio epidemics of the 1940s and 50s, and also the inspiring, although somewhat troubling, story of how this scourge was combated by an army of researchers and scientists desperately trying to discover a vaccine which could bring some sense of protection to the American public and really to citizens abroad as well. The story is a complex one told in remarkable detail in a new book called Polio, An American Story, The Crusade That Mobilized the Nation Against the 20th Century's Most Feared Disease. It's published by Oxford University Press. It's written by David M. Oshinsky, George Littlefield Professor of History at the University of Texas at Austin. And you perhaps know him for a previous book called A Conspiracy So Immense, The World of Joe McCarthy. Professor Oshinsky, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
It's interesting when we read that you especially have explored issues of politics. It's a sad fact that politics and wheeling and dealing and striving for influence and authority, that played a very major role in the story of polio in this country.
It did. The scientific community is often no different than the rest of us when it comes to the sharing of credit and the sharing of information and really who gets credit for what. And what you had in the case of polio were two researchers in particular, Jonas Salk and Albert Sabin, who had very different philosophies about what should go into a polio vaccine and how it should be made. And basically the entire scientific community took sides on this issue. It became extremely bitter, and Salk and Sabin remained enemies until their deaths in the 1980s and 90s.
The public maybe took sides. I get the sense that you did not, as a historian, which of course I suppose to some extent maybe goes without saying, but I mean really, I felt as I read this book like I was seeing both the shining exterior and the darker underbelly of both of these gentlemen. Neither of them were unflawed. Neither of them were without fault in this nasty dispute.
Well, I thank you, and I think that's quite correct. I think that Jonas Salk was seen by the American people as the great hero in the white lab coat, certainly our first celebrity scientist, and he was much less heroic within the scientific community, which felt that he had become somewhat of a publicity hound, and that his vaccine, which was very heavily backed by the March of Dimes, was inferior to the vaccine of Albert Sabin. Sabin was the hero of the scientific community, but not nearly as well known by the general public. And in fact, Jonas Salk did come out with the first vaccine. But you have to remember that 50,000 kids were getting polio each year at this time. It's a horrific paralytic disease of which many children died. And Jonas Salk was a very, very thorough researcher, and he had a vaccine that could, in fact, be produced safely and more quickly. It might not be the perfect cure-all, but at a time when so many kids were dying and being paralyzed, it was a wonderful measure. And for that, we, you know, owe tremendous thanks to Jonas Salk. The problem is that Albert Sabin looked at his vaccine and said, you know, I could go into the kitchen and make this. That's a direct quote. And it gives you a sense of sort of the scientific animosity. And one very interesting side note is that Jonas Salk was invited to the White House and he got the Congressional Medal of Freedom, his face adorned Time magazine, but he was never elected to the National Academy of Sciences. He was really sort of blackballed by others in the scientific community. So it was a very ugly dispute.
Let's talk for a moment about the dimensions of this disease, because it's interesting that in the wake of some of the difficulties which occurred after the Salk vaccine began to be disseminated, charges began to be heard that this whole situation, and especially within the scientific community, this idea that polio had been oversold as a menace to public health. Go ahead.
That's a very good question. I mean, if you look at polio in raw numbers, 10 times as many children died of accidents and 3 times as many children died of cancer at the very height of the polio epidemic. On the other hand, so you could say, well, the March of Dimes did oversell it, and the March of Dimes obviously collected more money than every medical philanthropy put together. They were amazing at using public relations and advertising and celebrities and poster children. They were the first ones to do this. On the other hand, they really made a compact with the American people, and that was that you give us your money, and you give us your dimes and your quarters, we're not asking for big donations, and you march for polio, and you collect money for polio, and you work for polio, and in the end, you give us your children to test this vaccine upon, and we will give you the prevention. We will get you the vaccine. And they did. I mean, they were good to their word. They may have oversold how polio was in comparison to other diseases, but it was a tremendous, horrific, fearsome disease, and it was a disease with no, there was no way to prevent it. You could have the, you know, the most careful parents in the world, and they could not protect you from this disease.
I appreciate the care you took in subtitling your book, The Crusade Against the 20th Century's Most Feared Disease, because that's exactly what we're talking about, of course,
right.
the level of fear which it inspired, even if in some cases that fear was maybe a tiny bit out of proportion. But it's probably important for those of us that were not alive at the time to better understand just how frightening this was. In particular,
yes.
Your book helps us understand how what made this especially bewildering and frightening was that it was often places that were especially clean, where sanitary conditions were especially good, that these terrible polio outbreaks would occur, not in the heart of the slums, for instance, where other diseases might run rampant. Polio was such a different sort of threat.
That is correct. Polio appears to have been a disease of cleanliness, and by that I mean it had always been there. It had always been endemic. But it reaches epidemic proportions only in the 20th century and only in Western nations, like, and particularly the United States, at the very time we're becoming an increasingly antiseptic nation. And what scientists have speculated is that as children became less and less acclimated to viruses, as they were, their exposure dropped dramatically because of a more antiseptic society, they did not come into contact with poliovirus at a young age at a time when they had maternal antibodies. And when they did come into contact with it, they had no immunity at all. So in some cases, dirt is not all that bad a thing. And it's something to think about as a society does become cleaner and cleaner and more antiseptic, that in some cases, this can work against you. And polio appeared to be one of these diseases.
What is interesting about it, and maybe this is a more ominous wrinkle to this question, I'm reminded of what some would say is now the controversy around anorexia nervosa, and the fact that some people believe that actually the numbers of cases of that are really pretty small, but because it is almost entirely a disease of the affluent, it has really attracted all kinds of attention. Again, some would argue out of proportion. Is that at all the case here with polio as well? If this had been a disease which was more concentrated in on the poor of our society, would it have received this kind of attention?
That again is a very good question, one that's hard to answer. I mean, statistics do show that probably as many poor black kids did get it as affluent white kids. On the other hand, it did seem to strike in areas that were cleaning up and in areas that were more affluent. And the real issue is everybody, therefore, had to become involved. In other words, if you were a mother who cleaned your house perfectly, and some of them actually sprayed DDT in their house, it didn't matter. It really didn't matter. Everyone was at risk, and all of the resources that you might have as a wealthier person were absolutely irrelevant in dealing with disease. Now, did this get the more affluent involved, and did they, you know, become big contributors in March and the like? Absolutely. Had this been a disease simply of the slums, would it have been treated differently? Probably. The answer is probably yes. And obviously, the symbol of this is Franklin Roosevelt. I mean, Franklin Roosevelt is 39 years old, couldn't have a more atypical polio victim or survivor. And Roosevelt is wealthy, comes from a, you know, one of the most prestigious families in the United States, healthy, athletic, 39 years old, and he gets polio. And when he gets polio, the sense is that anyone can get polio.
I have to say that my blood just ran cold when I read the story as you tried to help us understand how this could not only devastate the life of an individual but could devastate entire families. Yeah. We're right down the road from Milwaukee, and you tell the horrifying story of a family in which four children in succession within the space of maybe 5 days all die from polio. One family sustaining a terrible loss like this.
That is right. And the evidence seems to show that polio did run in families. In other words, that you were, if you had one child who had it, the chance of having the second child who had it were a bit higher. And the case in Milwaukee was just a nightmare because all of these kids essentially had bulbar polio, which is really where the muscles of the surrounding the diaphragm and your breathing apparatus closes down. And what was, I thought, most striking about that case was that each time another one of these children went into the hospital in Milwaukee, he or she knew that he or she wasn't coming out. In other words, they were what happened to their brother 2 days before would now happen to them. And they had fear written all over their faces, and the doctors could do nothing.
One of the things that was really interesting is that we had competing scientific philosophies, if you will, in terms of how a vaccine should be secured, and not just in the heart of the matter, which was should it be a dead virus versus a live virus vaccine, but also just the question of how this research should be carried out, and to what extent haste needed to sort of trump all other considerations. And I think for those of us who only learn about this through science fiction movies, this is really badly distorted for us. I mean, we have the idea now that, boy, a horrible thing comes along, well, you just whip up a vaccine as quick as you can and then you inject it into someone and hallelujah. But in fact, it to some extent needs to be a painstaking process. Where is the balance there, and where was the balance in 1950?
Well, by 1950, there was such incredible fear of polio that the sooner a vaccine was made, regardless of whether it was 100% effective, the more the American people would be relieved. And your question is really an interesting one. Albert Sabin, who had the live virus vaccine, had a trickier and more complex vaccine. It was going to take longer to develop, but he felt that once it was developed, it would give perfect immunity. On the other hand, you had Jonas Salk, who worked very, very quickly on a vaccine that was perfectly safe and largely effective. What Sabin feared is that if Salk vaccine came out first, everyone would forget about his vaccine, and that would be the end of it. And therefore, there was speed and haste. As someone said, Salk saw beyond the microscope. In other words, he saw how frightened the country was and that a stopgap measure, maybe not perfect, but that could be perfected over time, was better than waiting 5 or 6 years. You wait 5 or 6 years, you're talking about 250,000 kids who will come down with polio. And it really was a race for both speed and quality. And in some cases, historians would say that speed won out. But I look back on Jonas Salk, and I think, God bless him, he was a humanitarian. he came out first with his vaccine, and he really saved thousands upon thousands of children from getting polio.
Well, and it was interesting when his insistence that you tell us about that these trials not include placebos. He could not bear the thought of injecting a young person with a placebo. It was his desire that everybody should receive a real vaccine. He had to, I think, eventually compromise on that.
He did. That's a very good point. Jonas Salk believed that his vaccine worked. And what Jonas Salk said is, I am willing to inject as many children as volunteer, but I'm going to be darned if I'm going to give half of them sugar water as a placebo just to meet certain scientific criteria. But the scientific community responded and said, we will not take your results seriously unless you run a double-blind study, which means that half the children in this experiment will be getting nothing. And this is at a time right at the height of polio season. So you're taking several hundred thousand kids, and rather than giving them the real vaccine, you're giving them a placebo. But the scientific community said, we have to look at these results in the cold light of day, and if that means that half these kids are going to get a placebo, that's what will happen. And a lot of the kids who took the placebo, in fact, did get polio because they were not protected.
Yeah.
On the other hand, I will say that as part of the deal, all the kids who took the placebo would be first in line the next year to get the real vaccine if it worked.
Well, at any rate, you point out rightly that today the word polio describes a vaccine you take and not a disease that we fear. So we can be thankful for that, although there are ramifications even to the current day, which you also explore in this fascinating book called Polio, An American Story. Again, it's published by Oxford University Press, the author, David Oshinsky. Professor Oshinsky, I thoroughly enjoyed this book. I learned so much from it, and I'm grateful to you joining us on the morning show today.
Well, thank you. Believe me, it was my pleasure.
And we finish out today's morning show with a memorable, if brief, conversation that was recorded back in 2003. Words scarcely convey the sense of privilege and honor I have in speaking today with Madeleine Albright, who was the 64th Secretary of State for the United States and now the author of a remarkable memoir called Madam Secretary. Madeleine Albright, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you very much, Greg.
One of the things which I find so striking about your book is that you have a tremendous gift for describing other people, for seeing beneath the surface and understanding what makes people tick. I wonder what you feel is the importance or significance of that particular gift, if we'll call it that, in the work which you have done over the years as a diplomat.
Well, thank you so much for saying that. I truly do believe that for diplomacy, the personal relationships and understanding are very important. Obviously, there are national interest issues that you and whoever you're negotiating with have to have, but being able to understand what their background is, the context from which they're negotiating, and understanding their perspective, I think, makes a big difference. You know, putting yourself in the other guy's shoes, and to do that, you have to know a lot about them.
You speak at some points in the book about being a woman in this particular position. It strikes those of us that are just sort of amateur observers on the sideline that it is still quite uncommon for women to be in the diplomatic ranks. Is it, in fact, as uncommon as it seems to be?
It is uncommon, and I hope very much that I'm not a historical accident, that I did open the door for other women to have high-level foreign policy posts. There are not a lot of women in foreign policy throughout the world, and being an American, I decided that I had to have a network, and so I did get together with the other women foreign ministers and throughout the world, and in our largest number, there were about 14 of us. We were from all the continents, and it was very interesting to see how much in common we had in terms of trying to operate in a male world and how much we liked what we were doing.
It's interesting to contemplate how differently the world might operate if the diplomatic ranks weren't so heavily male.
Well, it's one of those questions that people talk about, and there's kind of a sense that the world would be more peaceful and that there would be more consensus. On the other hand, if you look at some of the women leaders like Margaret Thatcher or Indira Gandhi, Golda Meir, they were not always the ones that called for peaceful resolution. And I have to admit, I myself do believe in the use of force when it is the last resort to back a position of principle.
One of the things you mentioned is this is a sort of challenge in your kind of work which would be completely lost in the rest of us if you weren't telling us about it in the book, is that you have to not only engage in sort of big picture questions and discussions, but you also have to worry about details like the art of diplomatic kissing, which you talk about at one point. How does one in your position master those sort of small details of manners and etiquette and so on, which, of course, play a significant role in whether or not you're going to accomplish the work you set out to do?
Well, there are certain kind of rules that you know in terms of letting the other person speak first, and then there are a whole host of rules when you go into some foreign countries that the protocol people provide you, you know, like not crossing your legs and showing the sole of your shoes, or when I was in Mongolia, making sure that you try to drink their very peculiar milk. But some of it is just instinct, and I think that I grew up as a child of a diplomat, and I lived most of, you know, till I was 11 in foreign countries, and so I hope very much that I kind of have an ear for that. The diplomatic kissing is one of the things that makes me unique from my predecessors. But I did get confused because in some Latin American countries they kiss on the right cheek and some in the left, and so there were bumped noses, and some people kissed two times, and then the Dutch and the Belgians three times, and in Botswana four times. So it got confusing.
I should think. I mean, if there wasn't already enough confusion and complexity in what you do. As you mentioned, as you talk about the Clinton administration and how it operated, one thing you talk about is how historically the relationship between Secretary of State and National Security Advisor is a tense one. Why is that?
Well, I think partially, you know, the National Security Council system was set up at the end of World War II in order to try to get President Roosevelt to be more organized in his decision-making process. And so it is really the staff of the president in terms of working out foreign policy. And the State Department is an ongoing institution that handles America's diplomatic relations. But foreigners, when they come, want to get as close to the president as possible. So many of them want to have meetings with the National Security Advisor and the Secretary of State. And in some ways, it's a competition for doing the same thing. And it is a natural one, and in many ways it's healthy, and in many ways it gets in the way. There is also the problem of struggle between the State Department and the Pentagon, which we are seeing now in spades. And the role of the National Security Council Advisor is to try to mitigate those problems, which I think in our case, Sandy Berger did a really good job on.
You describe President Clinton so brilliantly as an admittedly imperfect but richly talented and well-intentioned man. I liked something else you said, which isn't quite so poetic, but I think so insightful. You said that President Clinton was a first-class picker of brains. What did you mean by that, and why did you think it was significant to say it?
Because I think the thing that is so engaging about him is that he is open-minded to many people's ideas, and he loved to listen to what we all had to say, and he read incredibly much, still does, and that he, what he does is pick people's brains, ask very difficult questions, and then use his own talents to kind of put together, I think, very bold positions, and he had an incredible curiosity. I think that is what really draws people to him.
Madeleine Albright, you'll be coming to the Chicago area, I think, for some book signings in the fairly near future, and I hope that maybe we'll get a chance to talk again. In the meantime, the book is remarkable, called Madam Secretary, published by Miramax Books.
Thank you, and I've lived in Chicago. I love it, and I'm looking forward to coming.
Very good. Thank you again for your time.
Thank you.
Once again, this interview with Madeleine Albright was recorded back in 2003 when this memoir was first published. And one more reminder that American Experience reruns its outstanding documentary, The Polio Crusade, tonight at 8 o'clock on PBS stations across the country, including Channel 10 in Milwaukee. And at 7 o'clock this evening, they are rerunning their documentary about the influenza pandemic of 1918. I'm Gregory Berg. Stay safe, everyone. And tomorrow on The Morning Show, a diversion from all that we're experiencing right now, a conversation from the archives about the wonders of bird watching, especially at the most elite sort of level. I'll speak with the author of To See Every Bird on Earth. Support for The Morning Show comes from Carthage College, home of the Aspire program and its multifaceted approach to career preparation. The new program is designed to cultivate leadership and entrepreneurial skills while empowering